Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Board Gamers Anonymous, the podcast about board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together.
This is Chris. And this is Anthony.
And this is episode 440, Most Popular Defunct TCGs and CCGs. We'd like to thank all our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode. All right, friends, we are talking about the mega, mega games out there that collected all of our interest. And 99% of the time, all of our money. We are talking about the CCGs, the TCGs, those card games that were so big that they became bigger than the industry itself. And, of course, they fell down and go boom, Anthony.
Yeah, and you know what? Honestly, this probably applies to every single TCG and CCG that isn't Magic, Pokemon, or Yu-Gi-Oh! For the last 25, 35 years.
Sure.
But there's a few of them that kind of stand out as games that some of them were successful for a period of time, like maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and then fell apart for whatever reason. Some of them seemed like they should be successful and then fell apart for whatever reason. And other ones were never successful, but you looked at it and you're like, well, that should work on paper, and it just didn't. So we're going to go through what these games were, why they failed, in our opinion, and you know, there's no particular reason why we're doing this. There's no other games coming out right now that are making everybody lose their mind that we might compare these to. I don't know.
It can't be anything mouse related. I don't know. I can't imagine at all there be something out there like that. But you know what's really interesting about this? I've engaged in some of these card games, but I was never a card gamer. Like, I was never a CCG person or a TCG person. But being that there's so many IP-related versions of these have always intrigued me, because I think for publishers, board game companies out there, this is like the holy grail. This is like the biggest possible win of all time if you could take your IPs and translate it into an infinitely producing money card game that is played everywhere by everyone, and there's a secondary market, and it's Beanie Babies all over again. You know, it's just like, it's the talk of the town, it's the toast of the town, it's literally everything it is out there. So I think it's such an intriguing idea and concept, and I know that, like, we've seen this a lot of times with board games too, where they try to go the other way, right? So you have a board game, they're like, hey, if we can make a CCG out of this, we'll make all the money. Or if we can make a miniatures game out of this, we'll make all the money. And there's been as many failures, I think, on that end too. So this one is about all the things that have happened, whether or not. All the lessons not learned, let's put it that way.
It's you know what it is, though? It is, there are two brands that are worth $1 billion.
Board Game is not, this is one of them.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh, okay. Uh-huh. I'm sorry. There's three brands that are worth $1 billion. And everybody wants in on that. The problem is that you can't just get in on that. It takes so much support. It takes decades to build up the support to get there. Magic the Gathering jumped from $440 million a year to $1.2 $1.06 billion in 2022 in gross sales. Pokemon made $1.6 billion in sales in 2022. No one else is even remotely close to those numbers, and they never will be, right?
Nope.
You've got Magic, which is the OG that apply, you know, everybody's interested in that from like age 9 to infinity. And you got Pokemon, which is a game that's perfectly fitted for children and is built into this brand cycle every 3 years with the new video games. You're not going to be able to replicate that. And a lot of these companies, and we'll get to it later, they launch a game, they expect to reach that level. And when they don't, if they only reach $100 million, they're like, well, that's not good enough. Let's axe the game. And it just keeps happening over and over again. And I'm not saying that's going to happen to Lurkana.
What?
But it's going. Who? It's probably going to happen to Lurkana. I don't see. No game makes it. They just don't make it unless you have low expectations, reasonable expectations. You're just not going to make it to that level.
Yeah. So we have a lot of discussion, as you can hear, about that coming up. But Anthony, Lurkana.
Yeah, I actually found some Lurkana cards. I bought them. I was at Barnes & Noble buying a gift for a friend, and I was checking out, and I saw behind the desk that they had starter decks. And I was like, oh, these are sold out literally everywhere in the universe. I should buy these, and I will play them, and I will report back to the podcast. This was yesterday, so I have not played them yet. My kids are out of town right now. But when they get back, we're going to play this game. I'm going to come back next week. I'm going to tell you all what I think. I'm sure it will be, it's fine, but we'll see.
Yeah, or it can be, it's the greatest game ever. Now your kids' college funds are gone because you're picking up Jasmine and Genie and Mickey and all those other characters. So.
That's true. But as long as all these crazy scalpers keep going nuts over these things, where am I going to find them to be able to do that? So
that's true. Well, if there's no podcast next week, you know what happened to Anthony. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. I'll be like, well, Anthony? He's like, I got to get some more iconic cards. I was like, oh, no. Oh, no.
It's happening.
No, there's been infinite amounts of crazy news because the cards got to the big box stores and obviously have gotten bought out. And, you know, the secondary market is exploding. And same thing with Disneyland and all those other stuff out there, too. So, again, I'm interested to hear your review if the system, if the mechanics are good for this game, because there's obviously endless number of Disney fans and endless numbers of Disney adults. Will they get into this? Will this be like a Wingspan situation where there is an outside group of people that are, you know, key or geared into a game that we're really into and will jump on board? Like, we just couldn't account for like bird watchers. Who knew?
Yeah, I don't know, man. The weird thing, though, is like, I feel like CCGs, they survive on the weird balance between people who collect and people who play. Because people who collect will buy anything on the secondary market, which feeds into a primary market, buying the cards to resell. And people who will play go to the game stores and buy the cards on a regular basis. That's why Pokemon's so effective, is because kids will go buy those cards constantly, and packs are not efficient way to get cards.
Sure.
Does Disney Lurkana needs to tap into that play market? It's got the collectors down. That's not a problem, but like, are there enough people to play it? I don't know.
Yeah, again, I think it's hard because I think there's so many more Disney collectors because Disney.
Right.
That just the collectors alone might carry that market
maybe
forever. It just, because look what Disney Plus is doing, right? Like, everything is re-released and live action, and their IPs are massive, and eventually they'll pull Star Wars back in.
Yeah.
You know, you have the Muppets, you have like, you have a lot of interesting, you have Marvel. Disney owns Marvel. Like, you know, it's just, it can go on forever. So, yeah, I mean, again, lots of fun stuff to talk about. Hopefully you're surviving the Lurkana chaos. And keep your heads down, kids. That's all I'm saying.
Yep.
But Anthony, turns out, surprisingly enough, Lurkana cards are not the only cards that everyone wants. I can't believe that's a thing I'm actually saying.
Yeah.
Turns out people will go to extreme lengths to get cards that are not Lurkana cards. What's going on with this world?
Yeah, it's nuts. It's almost like somebody would risk the 20 years in jail to steal a bunch of Magic cards.
What? What is this Magic thing? I only know about Lurkana. Yeah. Okay. What?
Well, remember again, Magic's up there on the top of that list. the billion-dollar brand. It's Hasbro's first billion-dollar brand, which is crazy. Hasbro, a company that's been around for like 100 years. Anyways,
yes.
They found the cards. That's where we're at now. So the update on the long-running saga of the stolen $300,000 in Magic cards from Gen Con, the Indiana police found said cards.
Quote, a lot of air quotes here.
Yeah, right. I know, like, they haven't arrested them yet, so you can't say, like, these people did it, or they've been accused of doing it. It's like, potentially they maybe did it, I don't know, but they found the cards, maybe, probably, I don't know.
Whoever the criminals may be, and however they may have been videotaped and photographed 35 different times wearing very identifiable clothing and no masks and everything else, somehow they surrendered / gave back the stuff they took. I mean, again, I'm sure a lot of lawyers are involved.
Yeah.
Just like, again, white collar crimes, people, doesn't, you know, SWAT teams are not coming after you for some reason. Other things, yes, not this for some reason.
It's not even white collar. This is
how much is it?
Grand theft, larceny, whatever. Like, this is a felony, well, right? $300,000.
I don't know. It depends on what land type is it, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Is it a black deck? Is it a white deck? Is it a green? Right? I don't know. Depends. I would love to see this actually go to court and then the jury having to listen to.
I know.
Like, what is this magic thing again? They stole magic? Come on, people. That's not a thing. It's, like, yeah, let's let them off.
A bunch of elderly Indiana residents being like, I don't understand what it is you stole, though. How is a piece of cardboard worth $300,000? Like, no. It was 100,000 pieces of cardboard worth of $300,000. Like,
yes.
It still doesn't make sense.
No, I just don't like the idea that they stole magic. Let's just say magic.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So.
That's crazy. So, but yeah, I mean, our stuff is starting to hit there. You know, like when people start stealing large chunks of it, right? Then you know that you really made it, right? Like, then you know, like, look, we're worth robbing. See? That's a thing that we're doing. So, but that's not the only thing. Anthony, I'm surprised to report, and I know that you're a fan, One Piece is on Netflix? How did that happen?
I don't know. I thought this was going to be terrible. Have you watched it yet?
I have not watched it because I know a lot about One Piece from watching endless clips that are shot at me through TikTok and everything else.
Fair.
So I could probably tell you a lot about it, never having watched the anime or read the manga, but I've heard it looks good. I'm surprised. Like, I can't believe I'm saying these words out loud.
I have watched enough of the anime to know everything that's in this series. Okay. I've watched about 200 episodes. This goes through like 100-ish of those episodes. And what I've seen so far, I've not watched all 8 episodes, but the first 3 I've seen, it's actually pretty good. And I did not expect that.
Wow.
Because it doesn't seem like something that would translate to live action particularly well. It seems like it would be cheap and plastic and rubbery.
Yeah, that's what you did there.
But it, you know, the thing that makes One Piece such a good show and manga is that the characters are very compelling. The relationships between those characters are very compelling. And they managed to capture that, not fully, because they do have to condense a lot, but pretty well, considering how much they're condensing. And the casting was really good. Like,
yeah,
all these characters are very well cast, which is another thing where I was very surprised they managed to pull off, because they're all over the top, and yet they all managed to find people who can be over the top in a realistic, relatable way. So I've kind of fallen down that One Piece well in the last year and a half, 2 years, and I was very excited to see this. So
it was funny though, because I've been catching bits and pieces of the reviews that have been coming out. Because, again, Netflix is just famous for, like, putting stuff out and then canceling.
Oh, they're going to cancel this. There's no way. It's the most ridiculous thing that they've ever even considered adapting. Like, you couldn't get through 2 seasons of Cowboy Bebop, but you think you're going to do, like, 15 seasons of One Piece? What are you doing?
Yeah, and it's just funny because a lot of the review people don't know anything about, you know, the anime, and they're just, or, the you know, any of the content. Then you're like, oh, it's like Game of Thrones. It has a lot of books. I'm like, oh my God, you have no idea what you're talking about. I'm like, they're like, hopefully they can keep up. I'm just like, no, no, they're fine. Yeah, they're fine. Yeah. They're fine. Like, maybe in 4 or 5 years when it wraps up, but like they're fine. Trust me, they're fine. I don't know anything about it, but the only thing I know about One Piece is it's got a lot. So you're fine. Yeah.
You've got 26 years of books to catch up to. You're good. You're good. If Netflix completed this, okay, first off, they won't. But if they did, then I would have a lot more people to talk to because everybody would know about One Piece.
Sure. And again, I just don't like certain elements of the artwork, to be honest. Like, I wanted to kind of engage with it, and it was like, there's just some stuff I just, like, I can't. It
grows on you.
Pushes back, I guess. But again, this is somewhat of a realistic take, because it has to be.
Right.
So, this might work really well for me, like, to absorb the story and not have to be pushed back from, like, the animation style. So. Yeah, again, if they could stick with it, if it did get good enough ratings, it would be almost like a winner for them for like, what, 10 years? I mean, they could.
It could be. I mean, if they can get 3 seasons out of this, I'd be happy. Because the second season would be Alabasta, and then you're in fully in the Grand Line from there on. I think that could be really interesting and fun. There's a lot of really cool stuff that happens in there, and new characters come in that I really like. But there's no way we get, like, into the later arcs of the show. Mm. Like, it's just that Netflix doesn't do anything that long. And this show looks kind of expensive. It really looks really expensive, which is cool. It's what makes it all work. But I thought the Luffy effects were going to be terrible. And I'm like, it's actually pretty good, which means this cost a lot of money.
Yeah. And again, I was surprised. IGN kind of panned it.
Yeah, like, that was the first review I saw, and then I was like, oh, maybe it's not good, and then I watched it, and I was like, no, I like it, and all the other reviews I've seen were, like, fine to good.
Alright, cool. So that's something to definitely check out on Netflix, and it's always good to support, it's always good to check it out, you know, at least catch one episode to see if you're interested. I'm gonna check it out, and I hope it's good. Like, variable success, but they've gotten better. Netflix has gotten better over time, so. Sure. I appreciate the effort to make this because they could use a winner. They could certainly, because I have Netflix and I don't know why I have it because there's nothing really good on it generally. So,
hey, they pulled off Sandman.
Oh, they did. I love Sandman, but Sandman has not come back yet. So
strikes. Everybody's on strike.
Yeah, that's true. Too.
But that is like the one thing where I'm like, they can't pull that off. And then they did. And then I said, there's no way they can pull off One Piece. And I'm like, I think maybe they did.
They're doing better. Yeah. I give them credit. Give them a lot of credit. So, I mean, I can't give them credit because they're not doing right by the actors now. Yeah, so, no credit. We stand with the unions, right?
Well, we're not giving Netflix credit. All they did was pay for it. We're giving the creative people who made One Piece credit.
That's right.
Who are now on strike. Good for them.
That's right. Support the unions wherever they are. That's a good thing.
Yes.
So, all right. So, that's what's going on in the world. Let's get on to the things that's going on with our listeners and our friends out there. Anthony, what's our question of the week?
All right, question of the week this week is, what's your favorite game to play in public? Malls, restaurants, game cafes, etc. And why? So, we've all done it. We've either gotten together as, you know, a meetup, a mall food court, or a Panera, or wherever, and we've played games around non-gamers, quote-unquote.
Oh, no.
So... What games are best or that you feel most comfortable playing around all the non-gamers out there? Personally, I don't care. I'll play whatever. So I was more interested in what other people have to say. Drew says exit games. Fantastic 1 to 2 hour disposable experiences. Food or drink spills on it. No worries. It's headed for the trash when you're done anyway.
Sure.
Ryan says, I don't often play in public, but if I do... Numbsters from Buttonshy Games. You generally play all of it in your hand aside from the remainder of the deck. It's fun and interesting decisions in a short play time. I like Numbsters. I gave it a play. I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. Any game you can play like with one hand. And in this case, Ryan's interpreting this purely as like solo games that you would play alone in public.
Sure. Gotcha.
Adrian says, at a women's retreat that was taking place in a hotel, I brought 6 Nymphs in case we had a break between sessions, and some in our group would be interested in learning a new card game. None of these gals are gamers. One gal was interested, and there were tables in an area that had a bar, but I wouldn't really describe it as a bar since it was light, bright, and airy. We did get a few people glancing over. Given the opportunity, I'd do it again.
So nice.
That's good. And Laudre says, I've enjoyed playing Scythe in public.
Oh, so bold.
Other end of the spectrum. such a fantastic table presence. It always gets noticed by other people. So that's from our Patreon backers. Over on Facebook, we had a few more answers. David says, point salad, just a deck of cards, and the scoring is always different. Joe mentions Love Letter and Handsome from Button Shy, are restaurant games that they enjoy. Scott goes a completely different direction, says Clank Legacy at a local brewery. But so many people stop and ask what is going on, it gets hard to finish at times. So you get distracted. So I think it's kind of the two directions here, it sounds like, is I don't want people to pay attention. I want something to be small and out of the way. Or I want the biggest, most ridiculous thing I can get to the table.
That's it.
So that everybody sees it and asks what's going on.
Exactly.
Like, Everdell was always that for me.
Oh, okay.
My game group in Pittsburgh, for a while, we met up at a local coffee shop. And I would always be amused when I'd set up Everdell because people would come over and be like, what's up with the tree? What's going on here? This big 3D tree on the table. It's like, obviously, you're all playing board games, but like, what's going on there? If I'm in like an airport or something, though, like card games, small card games, small table presence, people, they could think you're playing solitaire or magic or whatever. And they're not really going to ask or check.
Hmm. I guess for me, there's two answers here. Well, I guess there's three, maybe. So like, if I don't know where I'm going and I need to bring something that's going to stand up to any situation, it's going to be the Duke. Small board.
Good.
Solid wooden pieces, and the instructions are actually on the pieces, and then you have a draw bag that holds your pieces, which need to stay in the draw bag. So the footprint for this is super tiny, and those wooden chunky pieces are like nearly indestructible as far as like dropping or spilling or whatever it might be. But I agree with you. I think we're a different breed, which is we want to bring the most bombastic kind of game out there. One of the funny stories I had was we were playing Viticulture in the Panera Bread, and this family came by, and one of the little kids was like, oh, what's that, mommy? And the mom said, that's Italian Monopoly. And I was like, sure, why not? Like, that's close enough. We'll take it. Italian
Monopoly, I love it.
Yeah. So your frame of reference may vary, but I think And our friend Dave was always do something very smart, because we used to, I think one of the places we used to go to was like a brewery in New Jersey, and he would always take the game box, the cover, and set it up next to the game board, so as people walked by, they knew what game it was, and then that would give them an opportunity to engage with us. Like, oh, that's Brass, what's that? And then you could have that conversation, whereas if the box is not up and available, people might not feel comfortable with kind of engaging. So I always do that, weirdly enough, even if it's at someone's house. I'm like, let's set up the game box. Cause
I know. Yeah. I was like, what are you doing? Who are you showing off for? You're like, habit.
You know, it's the game box. We're doing this game. We should have the game box represented or something. I don't know. So yeah, that's fine. But yes, I highly recommend bringing the most colorful, super table presence possible, because it always brings more people to the table.
Yeah.
All right. So that's everything that's happened to our friends out there. Thank you again for joining us. All of our social media is out there. But again, because of the social media wars, which continue to rage on, Facebook tends to be the best, surprisingly enough. Or again, our Patreon account, patreon.com/BGA. All the good stuff happening. Our Discord channel's up there. Please join us. A lot of fun happening. Love to hear from you. And again, BoardGamersAnonymous.com. Board Gamers Anonymous got everything that you need. All of our social medias, our way to reach out to us via email. Again, we would love to hear from you and what's going on with gaming. Any questions, comments? Again, you can also rate us online at whatever podcast you're doing that, so that other people can find us. Anthony, let's talk about the games that we want to talk about, the games that we wanted to hit the table. Let's talk about our acquisition disorders this week.
Alrighty, so I'm going to be talking about a game that's on Kickstarter right now from Keymaster Games called Harvest. Now, Harvest is not a new game. This is a re-implementation of a game from 2017 that was published by Tasty Minstrel Games, which has sadly gone out of business in the last couple of years. So now we are getting the designers of those games getting the rights back to take the game to another publisher. In this case, the designer Trey Chambers has taken it to Keymaster Games, which most famously made Parks, which is a very well-regarded game about the national parks. Now, Trey Chambers has made several other, since then, larger, heavier games, including Argent the Consortium. I know, Chris, you've played and liked.
I'm a fan.
And Imperial Spells and Steam, which is like a magic version of a train pick-up and deliver game. So this is, you know, all new artwork, all new layouts, lots of new elements from what I can tell. Harvest, the original version of 2017, was not the most big and sprawling game in the world, and it certainly wasn't the prettiest game. It was kind of a weird, it was Tasty Minstrel artwork, right? Like, there was a certain kind of look to it. It didn't quite work for me, and mechanically the game was fine. So this is a worker placement game in which you play a farmer, and you are trying to build the best farm, right? It has a pretty flat graphic design in this new version. Very, very orange. Like, so orange. So orange, it gives me, like, a feeling inside, like, from the orange, and I can't even, like, recognize what the feeling is. But every time I look at their artwork, I'm like, okay, I feel something here. But one of the things that's most interesting about the game is that you're not just playing, you know, it's not like an Uwe Rosenberg farming game. It's a much lighter game. It's like 45 minutes to an hour and a half. You have asymmetrical powers as your farmer. So you could be the water wrangler, which is a frog, or the poop princess, which is a pig, or the handy bird, which is a woodpecker. And then your powers will kind of influence how you interact with the different available abilities and how you build out your farm. There's a solo mode that's kind of been augmented into the game, and a bunch of additional stuff and upgrades that they've added. So there's new character cards, they have animeeples and buttons. And just overall, like, production quality looks really nice and high quality. And Keymaster Games has always done a pretty good job of this. This is, I feel like, them kind of leveling that up a little bit, though, because their previous games were a little bit lighter, a little bit smaller. So, like, Caper and Parks and the expansion for Parks. These are like $30, $40, $50 games. Pretty straightforward. Harvest is a bigger game, and they're going for broke here, right? You're getting, like, screen-printed wooden crop tokens and premium metal coins in the shapes of acorns and mushrooms and, like, inserts to keep all your stuff organized and play mats and all this stuff. And meeple packs with screen printing on them with the buttons involved. So the game, if you want all the fancy extra stuff, is $150, which, and it's $59 for retail, which is probably normal. I don't know. We'll see what the shipping is. The $150 for all the fancy extra stuff. Having played Harvest, and again, yes. They've made updates, they've made changes, they've made tweaks to the rules, so maybe it's amazing now. But the original version of this game was fine.
Sure.
It's a 7.1 on BGG, and I'm like, yeah, it seems about right. Maybe a little lower. I don't love it. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just like a very there worker placement game. So I don't think I'll back this because the prices are just too high, but it is very cute. I love the aesthetic. I like the stuff they've added. I just wish I knew how it played differently, if it plays differently, right? Like, where the changes are. And they've outlined a few of them, but, like, I don't see anything on this page that really kind of walks me through what that is, right? Like, you go into these pages sometimes, you get videos from the publisher, you get videos from influencers that they've paid to make videos, whatever it is. In this case, they've got, like, their Dice Tower video that they've paid for and like one other video, and it's just like, I'm not really getting a good sense of what's different here or why I would want to buy this if I could just go get the old version for like $15.
Yeah.
So if you love the old version, then this is probably exciting for you. I think what's telling here is that only 63 people have backed the super version.
Yeah.
And they honestly don't have a ton of backers overall. They're, you know, the early bird stuff is kind of up. Okay, I have to correct that a little bit. They did early birds. The early bird backers, there's like 700 or so on the fancy version, but still like less than a third of total backers.
Absolutely.
So anyways, Etz Harvest, that orange, I don't know what it is, man. The orange cover is like doing something to my soul. But it's so much orange. But I was immediately captivated, and I want this game, and I can't pay that much money. It's so much money. And like,
it's crazy
how much less you get for the 59. I'm like, I can't, you know, I would need at least need to spend the 90, and then I'm like, $100 for this game? Nah. So Harvest, friends, if you got money to spare, check it out.
I was surprised you put this on here, because I did look through this, and the gameplay just doesn't at all come close to living up to the price. But I get it, because this has some of the best components I've seen on Kickstarter in quite some time. The artwork, the graphic design look fine, but the components are gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And I wish that I could actually just purchase the components, because the coins look great, the strawberries, the wheat, the blueberries, all everything, all the components look great, and I could actually use those in other games, not to mention the Animeeple pack and stuff like that. So it makes a lot of sense, but I think I agree with you, and I think you pointed it out correctly, is outside of the early bird situation, which is nonsensical. I actually get hostile about that. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's a terribly unfair scheme to get people to back something that there is neither the time nor the consideration to like properly look through, hear reviews, you know, go through the rule books, maybe play some online version of it. And if you did not make that very tiny window, which is usually like less than 24 hours, and we've talked about this with a lot of campaigns, now you feel like I'm being penalized.
Right.
It doesn't feel like an early bird. It feels like a penalty. Mm-hmm. This is a campaign to support the production of a game that supposedly, air quotes, is not going to get produced without our support. Again, I'm not a child. I get it. I understand this kind of economy here. But since we're still operating under Kickstarter, you know, mission goals and something like that, I'm supporting you. Why are you penalizing me with $10, $20 more for the same game a day later of backing? You're still getting my money, and it's going to take 2 years. It's an investment that I'm making in you. I don't appreciate that. I just never appreciate that with any early bird, not just this campaign, but any early bird. I just don't like it. I'm just not a fan. So when the retail version that's currently out has 26 backers, and you're like, well, that's terrible. Like, I appreciate that they put a retail generic kind of version so you could back it. Awesome. But the reason why you're backing this campaign is because because the components are so good, and that is $149? Like, it's like $90 more for components for an okay game. Stop doing that. Come on. I understand people have money, and I support that, but like, I don't know, man.
The numbers are getting crazy, and I don't know. There's a bubble going on here, and I'm not an economist, so I'm probably misusing that word, but there's a bubble here. I feel like we're close to it breaking, where people are going to say, you know what? Nope.
I mean, honestly, like, I love games. I've spent a ridiculous amount on games. I spent a ridiculous amount to upgrade games. I bought these upgraded versions, but you can't, in good faith, tell me you just can't tell me that a $90-$100 bump for components for this level of game is warranted. It's I don't know. I just have a problem with it. I don't know. It's, and then it's shipping and everything else on top of it. So I don't know. It's a hard pass for me for several reasons.
Oh yeah. I'm not buying this either. This literally falls in the category of, oh, this looks cool. Oh, I kind of think I would be interested in this. And then you look at the price, you're like, no.
Well, Anthony, I got one for you, because nostalgia bait, my friend. Nostalgia bait. So if you're a kid of a certain age back in a certain day, there was a video game called Worms. And it was fun. If you know about Worms, the video game, I don't have to say anything more to you. If you don't know about Worms, the video game, you're more than likely not going to have any interest in the fact that now there's Worms, trademark, and they actually put the trademark in the title, which it bothers me. The board game, hilarious Worms, trademark, gameplay on your table. Grab your friends and unleash classic weapons, sneaky tactics, and all-out multiplayer mayhem. First off, why the trademarks here? Like, do we not understand this stuff is trademarked? Like, do we not know that? Like, I don't know.
Hey, well, man, look, there's a brand guidelines. You got to follow the brand guidelines.
So bad. And again, the brand, like, I mean, Star Wars doesn't do that. And like, they have a brand. Like, yeah. I don't know. All right. So if you are still interested, let me explain. So Worms is all about these really cute little critters who want to blow up the other cute critters on the board. And it's got this really nice, fun kind of cartoony style. And they basically look like thumbs that are carrying like different wacky comical weapons on them. So bazookas, flamethrowers, bats, guns, grappling hooks, all kind of crazy stuff. So you get a team. Everyone gets a team of their particular color. And then there's a hex map that is interchangeable, kind of arrangeable and stuff like that. And your job is to blow up the other teams. So you place your worms out there. You have a hand of cards. Those cards have different weapons. And those weapons are there to knock out the other players, of course, on the table. There's also crates, which will give you other weapons to add to your deck so that your worms can do other things. Despite the fact that the worms have a weapon in their hand, doesn't mean that they're stuck with that weapon. You can play any card possible. You shoot the other worms or blow them up on this board, they fall down. You do it again, they get knocked out. And primarily, that's what you do. That's the game in a nutshell. Why you're backing this is, again, for two reasons. One, you have a really deep and meaningful nostalgia for the video game. Or, this is kind of cute and fun, and it would be cute and fun. Again, at least the length, or what they say the length will be for this game, is like, it's supposed to be somewhat quasi kind of party game-ish. I don't know if that's necessarily the case, because there is not independent reviews on this. So it looks fun. It looks fine. It looks like there's a lot of wackiness and different characters here. Again, if you want the base level here, and this comes from Mantic Games, who've created a lot of games, so they're a real company. It's about $100, Anthony, for the base player.
Stupid.
Okay? Now, if you want the Armageddon Pledge, which adds landscapes and some other stuff, then you're talking like some other plastic bits on the board. $150, my friend. $50 more for a bunch of like barrels and boxes that are unpainted. So, yeah, that's a thing that's happening on Kickstarter, my friends. Mantic Games. I don't know, like,
there's
again,
there's not that much in here. What are they charging for?
They're charging a lot of money for the IP trademark, I guess.
Of Worms? So, of Worms.
Of Worms.
The tongue-in-cheek game that nobody ever took seriously, Worms.
100%. Okay. Man. Like, look, they've had a lot of IPs. They had Umbrella Academy. They had Hellboy. I don't know. Like, I saw it. I was like, cool. I remember that was a kid. Maybe I'll back it as a lark, as a joke, as fun, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's got to be like $50 because it's this very small IP that only a couple of people probably really played or engaged with and might actually want to get to the table. And then I saw $100 and $150. That's like,
gosh.
I was like, why would you think that would be a thing? But if you are for some reason interested and or engaged in this kind of stuff, it's up on Kickstarter, and there's 11 days to go, and they have about $370,000+ for backers there. So some people have money. I don't know. Not me, but other people. You know, this is, yeah. So, yeah, you know, it's a thing. Okay. All right, well, there are acquisition disorders for somebody out there. If no other reason, these are fun campaigns to take a look at and just shake your head, I guess. I guess that's what we're doing.
That's what we're doing.
All right.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Anthony, let's talk about the games that did at the table this week, and we'll let everyone know if those games are a buy and they should run out and pick those games up, if those games are a play and they should sit down and play them, if those games are a dodge and they should avoid them, or in fact, those games that dreaded burn, and let's be honest, $100 worth of additional components are not going to do it any better. Anthony, what did you play this week?
Okay, so I finally got a chance to play War of the Ring, the card game, Against the Shadow.
Ooh.
Epic journey here. Getting this to the table. This was the first, we got it to Gen Con. We went straight over to Ares game booth. I stood in line. I got this expansion. They sold out like 3 hours later. Happy I did. And then my luggage got lost on the way home. And one of the very few things that was not in the luggage when I finally got it back was my copy of War of the Ring, which I had brought with me to Indianapolis so we could practice ahead of our tournament. So it took a while. And then I got a new copy from Amazon. And finally got this to the table recently. This is a weird expansion for a first expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't you agree? Like, a 1-2 player bot expansion that replaces the Shadow deck. But I personally, I was super fascinated, but I can imagine a lot of people having no interest in this whatsoever. So it's a weird place to start.
The only thing I would say, and you and I talked about this early on, is to play the game as it's meant to be played, you must have four players.
Mm-hmm.
And it only plays four players, like, in its real form.
Right.
So that is a hard number to get.
Yeah, 100%. It's such a weird thing. So anyways, let me explain what this is. In the box, you get... not a lot for $30. You get replacements for the two shadow decks. So okay. You get 60 cards that replace the two shadow decks. You get 6 new combination locations and battlegrounds and paths that replace certain cards in those decks if you're playing with this expansion. And then you get the player aids. That is it. There are 66 cards in this box, which is a big box. Not a full-size box, but a pretty big box. And it's like $30. So, I think that's silly, but I'm going to get a lot of play out of it. So, I don't even think it's necessarily bad for me personally. But if you bought this separately, I could see you being like, what? What this is, though, is you are playing either solo or cooperatively, one or two people, against the Shadow Bot decks. Now, if you've ever played a game that uses bots... especially like with flowcharts, because that's what it is. There's a flowchart.
Sure.
You're probably a little hesitant here. They tend to be cumbersome, time-consuming, confusing. This is actually pretty straightforward, the way that the flowchart works. I was pleasantly surprised that it wasn't too crazy. So basically what it is you look at all the cards available, and you see, can I use an action on any of them? If the answer is no, you check, you go down like the path to see if you should pass. You almost never pass as the bot. Then you see if you can move something from your reserve into play. And then if not, you can play a card. Cards are laid out face down. And you just play them randomly from the bot's hand. And that's basically it. Like, by the end of the first time I was playing it, I didn't have to look at the flowchart anymore. And it's kind of had it in my head. And the rules say that that's probably what will happen. So it was a nice, pleasant surprise how quickly and efficiently it kind of flowed. You can play it in just as many ways as the base game. So you can play solo in either using the trilogy or fellowship rules where you just play 1v1, or you can play solo playing the full rules where you play multi-hand, the two fellowship, the two free people sides versus the two bot sides, and the bot would run each of the two decks. I found that to be somewhat cumbersome. I don't like multi-handing in any mm-hmm. solo game. And that's honestly, it's designed for co-op play. So I think that's where the co-op comes in. You have one person playing the Hobbits, and then you have one person playing the Elves and the Dunedain, and they face off against the two shadow sides. But overall, like, ignoring that part, because I have not had a chance to play it fully co-op with someone else, but I've played it the three ways that the game is designed, which is the full version, the trilogy, and the co-op, and the fellowship. I think it works really well. I had a lot of fun. I got deep into the game. I was working through my strategies the same as if I was playing a human being, and the scores in all three of those matches were relatively close. There is a normal mode and a hard mode. The normal mode, basically, the bot draws fewer cards. And the reason for that is one of the main rule changes here is the bot does not have to spend a card to play a card. So whenever the bot plays a card, they just take a random card from their hand and plays it out. And that means that they get more card play than you might get. You have to get creative and think strategically about where you want to play and how you're going to play and what you're going to use to play it. They just get to play a card for free. Of course, it being a bot, it means a lot of cards end up in their reserve sometimes. And again, because it's a bot, sometimes you get lucky, sometimes the bot gets lucky in a way that wouldn't necessarily happen in a 1v1 game or a 2v2 game, because they are everybody's thinking tactically.
Sure.
So you can't perfectly recreate the feeling of playing War of the Ring, the card game, 2v2, which is still, like, in the last 5 years, one of my best gaming experiences, but you can get kind of close, which I think is admirable. Like, that's hard to do for a game that's so complicated, has so many layers and so many nuances to it. It makes sense they had to completely rebalance the entirety of the shadow decks to make that work, and I'm glad they did that, and they didn't just say, like, here's some solo rules and they're terrible, have fun. Like, they rebalanced all of it. They re-released it all as a standalone expansion, and it works. Does it completely replace it? Will it help you get better at the game? I don't. Maybe a little on the latter, because you'll learn the cards, but you won't learn the shadow cards because they're different than if you played other people. So, for me, someone who loves War of the Ring, the card game, who loves just being able to practice games I enjoy, and it has fun playing solo experiences, this is a buy. But there's a few caveats in there, obviously, that you can hear. So you should enjoy playing solo experiences, co-op experiences. You should be aware that the game is different fundamentally, and that for the first one or two times you play it, you're going to follow this flowchart pretty carefully for every turn. That'll slow you down a little bit. But if none of that bothers you, the experience that I had was pretty fantastic. And I think this is a very fun, clever, well-implemented expansion. I'm very excited for the next expansion, though, because that will add content for all four players.
Sure.
However rare we get that to the table. So, War of the Ring, the card game, Against the Shadow, that's a buy for me. Just make sure it's a good fit for you and your playstyle before you pick it up.
Yeah, I'm interested to see the or play the co-op version too.
Yeah. Yeah, next time we're together, man, we're going to do it.
So then the play, so again, you can play the two, the base game. But
yeah.
If you play the short version or is good, but it's a short version, you play the full version, it's a little wonky.
Yeah.
But then if you play the four player, but so now this allows you to play a real two player, which might be a sweet spot. I'm looking forward to playing that.
Yeah, and one of the most interesting things it does is you can't win by 10.
Okay.
So the game it's been rebalanced a little bit, so mm-hmm. it can swing a little bit harder one way or the other, and you don't end the game when it swings too hard in one direction. So all three games I played ended within 3 points, both sides, which I thought was really interesting. And so, but in all three of those games, I think there was a point at which one side was winning by 10. So I think it's probably just like the side effect of the balancing act that Ian Brody went through here. I don't know that that would work with live players, but something that in this worked pretty well. And I would really like to see how it plays out in co-op.
And then the just for a second, because I know we got a chance to look at the next expansion that's coming out. What is that supposed to do? That's not a co-op. That's more players? I know it's more factions, right?
So the new expansion is two new factions, which off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly what they are.
The Ruffians? There's some bad dudes.
Right, yeah. So it's 2 to 6 players now. Fire and Swords is the name of the new expansion. And yeah, it brings in the Ruffians and cannot remember the Free People side.
It's the Dane? Is it Dane and Dane's crew, or is it?
It might be, yeah.
Yeah. It just brings, it's more players then.
So yeah, they're it's 2 to 6.
Which is weird that they, like you said, that they didn't go with the 2 to 6 and then go to the co-op kind of solo.
Yeah. One of the first questions on Board Game Geek is, will this expansion be compatible with the next one that comes out in the spring? There's no answer yet, so I don't know. And we didn't think to ask that when we met Ian Brody. But I'll be interested to know.
We will ask Ian Brody.
Yeah. What I would hope they would do is something like what Imperial Settlers did, is every new expansion, they would throw 2 or 3 cards into the deck with the expansion. Mm-hmm. And that made it compatible with the early expansions.
Sure. Nice. I'm looking forward to it. Well, one of the other big games from Gen Con 2023 was Sea Salt and Paper. This was a very small box card game. It was 2 to 4 players, and really what drew everyone's interest was the amazing origami artwork that was photographed for the cards. This game sold out. It was one of the big games, and again, it was kind of surprising because considering all the other big games that were at the convention, this is a small box game that fits in your hand. Again, great artwork, big fan of the artwork, but does it play well? Now, the game itself, it doesn't, it's an abstract game. Like it's just an abstract game with great artwork. Again, the description here is a few delicate folded papers and a whole marine universe comes to life. That's as much flavor text or description as you're going to get. It's primarily just a bunch of cards. So
yeah,
you can play this 2 to 4. I will say right off the bat, I think it plays best at 2, and I'll explain why. The game really comes down to, I would say, like a 4 different types of cards. And I'll explain why that actually is it for. We'll say. So first up, you on your turn, there's a deck of cards, and you will either draw 2 cards from the face down deck, select one, and then put the other one on one of the 2 discard piles, and then you put that into your hand. Or you could take one of the 2 discard cards, one of the cards on the discard piles, choose one of the 2. And then put that in your hand. Now, obviously, if you're taking from the discard, people know what you're doing. Why does that matter? Well, that's the only action you're taking throughout the game, which is taking cards and playing cards. Now, the only cards that you will be playing is duo cards. Now, duo cards are cards types. There's crabs, there's boats, there's fish, and then there's this really interesting combo of a swimmer and a shark. If you got the pair, the duo pair, you place them both cards down in front of you, and then you do the effect. So for the crab card, you get to choose through the discard piles. All right, crabs are scavengers. They get through to go through the discard. That's a fairly helpful card, duo card, because that effect is going to allow you to do some set collection, which I'll talk about in a second. The boats allow you to take an extra turn immediately. Awesome. The fish cards let you take the top card of the deck and put it in your hand. Awesome. The combo of the swimmer and the shark lets you take a card from the opponent's hand. Or if there's multiple opponents, you get to choose who you're going to take that from. Beyond that, everything else that happens in the game happens behind your own hand that no one gets to see. You're playing those duos out. they're worth 1 point each. This is a point game. So again, depending on the number of players that are in the game, whoever hits that point total or goes beyond it wins the game. So that's pretty much straight up. Now the rest of the cards, and there's some interesting cards. There's mermaid cards. It looks like Ariel. It just looks like Ariel, right? So that origami Ariel, she's interesting because she will score you 1 point for the most color cards that you have. So no matter what type they are, there's several colors in the game. I will say that this game does a great job of being colorblind friendly because there are symbols on the card and there is a separate card that helps people who are colorblind friendly to colorblind friendly, who have challenges with their sight to be able to determine what symbols are matching what colors. So you get a point based on the mermaids. The mermaids also do something really crazy, which reminds me of Glory to Rome. If you get four of them and you play all four, which you would, you automatically win the game.
Okay.
But no one's going to do that because the mermaid cards are the most valuable cards in the game. Beyond that, there's a set collection. There's shells, there's octopi, there's penguins, and there's sailors. Each of these have different set collection scoring. The shells are the least, then the octopi, and then the penguins, and then finally the sailors. So the number of cards that are out there that are available kind of stretches out how many points you could score. So the smaller selections like the penguins and the sailors are going to score you the most points for the least amount of cards, but the shells are going to score you the most. But the question is, do you have enough time to score all those shells? Well, that's the challenge here. Finally, there are multiplier cards. There's one for ships, there's one for fish, penguin, and for sailors. They're just going to score you additional points for having those cards in your hand. The more rare the particular type of symbol on the card, the more the multiplier is going to benefit you. Now, here's the crux of the game. This is where you have to really pay attention. As you're playing cards, the duo cards out, you're scoring points, but you're also scoring points in your hand, again, based upon those collector cards, the mermaid cards, and the multipliers. When you personally hit 7 points, you have an opportunity to continue with the game, or you could say stop. If you say stop, the round comes to an end, and all players reveal their hands, and you score the points. That's pretty much it. So everyone scores the points. So you might say, I feel like I have a couple more points than my opponent. I might want to score my points here now, so maybe it's a difference of like 2 or 3 points, but you stop and you score the points. If you say last chance, then everyone gets to take one more round to collect, I guess an additional card or such, but once you say last chance, no one can steal cards from your hand, so the shark swimmer combo becomes moot at that point, but it's kind of like a press your luck situation. And everyone gets to play one more turn, and then you reveal your hands. If you're the person who says last chance, and you have the most points, you in additional get to score your colors on your card. So you get to take basically what is a mermaid bonus, and you get to score those points as well. If you lose, and someone else had more points than you, guess what? You don't get to score the points on your cards. You get just to score the color bonus, but everyone else gets to score the points on their cards. So there's a press your luck situation. You're scoring additional color bonus or not scoring your points. That is the most difficult thing to wrap your brain around because you might want to say, I feel like I have just enough points and I want to get out. Or I might want to really gamble because I have a really good hand of cards and I have a lot of cards of the same color, plus I have a lot of points, I'm going to gamble here. That's a possibility. So because any player who hits 7 has the opportunity to stop the game immediately, the round immediately, or push his luck a little bit more, the set collection cards become a lot more difficult to kind of engage with because you may not have the time. The gameplay is incredibly fast because, again, almost always you're going to stop the game at your 7 plus at that point or press your luck a little bit. Pressing your luck doesn't happen as much as you think, because throughout the game, if another player is not taking discards that are face up, you have almost no idea what they're holding on to beyond what the duo cards are in front of them. So I'm taking cards. You have no idea. Yeah, you could steal a card, maybe, but I don't know if you have two or three mermaids. I don't know if you have a bunch of sailors or a bunch of penguins. I don't know. So it's a fun little card game, and that's all it is. It's great. The artwork is fantastic. I like it. It's definitely a play.
That's a lot of rules for a little card game, man.
Yeah, that little press your luck slash end is kind of a weird thing. Otherwise, it would just be a normal game that you'd play to a certain number of turns and show your cards, and whoever scores points, score points. I don't know. That's what they did. They did a thing. It's a thing. It's fine. I don't know. Like, I didn't find the press your luck element necessarily fun, because I never got... there's no way to track what someone else is doing if they're not taking discards.
True. Yeah. I don't know. It looks cute. I would try it, and it's not crazy expensive like everything else we talked about today. So
it's worth. You could pick this up for, I guess, give or take $10 to $15. So
not bad.
Yeah, no, I do recommend it. It is a play. You could buy it. Again, the artwork. Again, if you buy this, it's because the origami artwork is really fun and outstanding. So, And I think there'll probably be expansions to this at some point. But yeah, no, it's definitely a play. If it's your thing, like you said, because of the price, certainly a buy. It was a Spiel des Jahres recommendation, so for 2023. So yeah, good stuff.
Cool.
All right, so that's everything that hit our table this week. Anthony, let's get on to our feature review. Our feature review this week, of course, the most popular and yet defunct TCGs, CCGs, the card games that were going to bring in all the money, that were going to pay for your kids' college fund, and then somehow just fell flat. There's a lot of them. How did that happen? Anthony, take us away.
All right. So we didn't go through all of them, because there's like 80.
Oh, there's more than that, right?
It's
crazy.
Every company on the planet has tried to do this at some point. And two companies in particular just kept doing it over and over and over and over again. So we're going to touch on a few of them that we personally have connections to, or that were really hyped and fell apart, or that represent IPs that just have not been able to get it going and keep it going.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with a fun one, though, because this is one we played each other on 5 years ago at Gen Con, where it launched, Munchkin Collectible Card Game. So this was interesting for two reasons. One, Munchkin.
Yes.
Fun artwork. And two, it was designed by Eric Lang with Kevin Wilson. So pretty solid design team. Respectable IP behind it. And yet it died almost immediately. Within a year, it was dead.
Yeah. It was, it again, I'm raising my hand. You can't see it. I'm that person that will raise their hand and will say that, again, mostly because of the artwork, but also because I do appreciate a fun board game or card game, because we don't have a lot of those out there, just to be honest with you. We don't. So Munchkin has always been a fun collectible game hobby of mine. So when they came out with the CCG here, I was like, oh, I can do this. This is a lot of fun. And what was interesting about this game was there was a bluff mechanic to it. So you could actually say that you're playing a card of a certain value, and then they could challenge you on that. So this was good. It had all the classes. It had all the crazy cards. It had the boosters. We played it at release time. I got a bunch of it, but really right now at this point, you could buy a huge booster gravity drop for like $10.
Yeah.
which I've thought about because I like the artwork and the collectability of it.
Right.
But even I've been like, $10 is a lot for a box for a game that I will never play. Like, oh, that's a cool card. Oh, I get that. All right. I've chosen poorly in my life. I'm fine with that. But it's still out there and available. I again, the bluff mechanic was kind of okay slash cool. I don't know. Steve Jackson Games does a lot of good things good. I don't know why. I guess the organized play just never came together for this.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we could have a whole separate episode and we'd probably need to bring on a guest. But, like, what makes a TCG successful? And sure. I feel like it's a very specific blend of ingredients. You can't just focus on one. You can't just focus on, you know, collectability. You can't just focus on organized play. You can't just focus on IP. It has to be this very particular mix at a particular balance and temperature and everything. And it's really hard to get right. As witnessed by the fact that there's only like 8 or 9 TCGs going at any point in time, and most of them are dead, like in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, and I think if I remember correctly, there was also problems and printing errors in their first run.
Yeah, that's
no so good. That caused a lot of issues that obviously people who are playing the game for the game really did not like, because they have to play that game.
Yeah, yeah, you do. You want it to look good.
It's true. So,
all right. Next up, we're going to dive into, and the next few of these are IPs. The vast majority of these are IPs, actually, because these are the ones that people are most excited about, and it's most relevant to what's going on right now in the world with the TCGs that people are most excited about. So the 2001 release of Harry Potter Trading Card Game was, people were pretty excited about it. It was backed by Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
Yeah, like, and here's the thing. Wizards of the Coast released a bunch of different TCGs and CCGs from like 1995 to like 2005, 2010-ish, before everything took off and Magic just became so big they didn't have to worry about like diversifying. But this was one that feels like it should have worked.
Mm-hmm.
It came out in 2001, right before that first movie, and after that first book. The first release, and then the first three expansions, all related to the first book, and then the last expansion before they canceled it, related to the second book. They could have done like 50 expansions before they ran out of books.
Sure.
And then they could have just done them all over again. And people... Yeah. I feel like if they had launched this 5 years later, it would have worked.
Mm-hmm.
It's not immediately clear why it failed so much as Wizards of the Coast decided to stop doing it. So whatever goals they set financially, this game did not hit those goals. It ran for a little less than 3 years, which is pretty short in general for any TCG. There's certainly been shorter ones, but in terms of like the hype that was around it, it died pretty fast. I think part of the problem here, like editorializing, is when you launch a TCG, especially in the 2000s, you need a core audience. And if that core audience is young, you need an older audience who can support them. So Harry Potter was still relatively new in 2001. Like the books have been around for like 5 years. You needed the adults to be in on it too, and they were not yet. Now, sure. You could do this now, and it would be super successful, minus the whole J.K. Rowling being potentially a terrible person. probably holding it back. So maybe you could have done this in like 2012, before people sure. realized that. So yeah, this is one that seems like it should have worked, and maybe it was just bad timing.
Yeah, I mean, again, this has... the books and the Harry Potter houses and the spells and the characters. I mean, this is just, it's built for a CCG.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously there must've been some internal shenanigans, or again, sometimes with Wizards of the Coast or with some other companies, like if it doesn't make $1 billion, they don't want to invest any more money into it.
Sure.
So like you said, I think certainly the adult population not being on board yet, but now, you know, everybody over the last, I mean, again, give or take scandals and everything else that's happened over the last couple of years, people sort themselves into hats and houses with the hat and stuff like that. Like, I can't, it's hard to believe this didn't stick around or didn't get revived at some point.
Yeah, it's surprising. Like, and Harry Potter media keeps coming out.
Yes, the video game was supposedly very good, and they're going to have a TV series. I don't know if it's on HBO Max, I think.
Yeah, Max.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, we'll see, maybe.
Jeez.
With the craziness around Locana, I could easily see companies being like, well, maybe we could just make this work.
Sure.
All right, next up, we're going to get into a series of games that were released by Decipher. So Decipher being kind of like, there was Wizards of the Coast with Magic and then all the games they tried to do after that. And then Decipher was actually really big and a huge competitor to Wizards all through mm-hmm. the '90s, from like 95 on, up through like 2007. So this one was released in 2003, probably the least successful of the bunch. Beyblade trading card game. Only had one set. It's based on the Beyblade anime series, but Beyblade was very popular for like 2 years in those early 2000s, and people were really hyped about this game when it came out. Do you remember Beyblade?
I do. And I did not know they made a CCG about it, but yeah, no, it was pretty popular for like that 5 minutes that it was out there in the world. It was a thing.
Yeah. This game best represents like that kind of anxiety we all get when a new CCG comes out. We're like, is this going to be big? Are people going to be excited about this? Should right. I buy all these cards? And then 6 months later, if you did buy them all, you're like, oh man, that was a waste of money.
Yeah, and I think it was certainly after the time of like people realizing Magic is worth money. So why, again, right? Like, it was backed, it was supported, so why wouldn't this make money and support?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, early 2000s especially. There's a lot of these. All right, next up we have the Middle Earth collectible card game. This was released not by Decipher, which we'll get to in a second, but by ICE. Iron Crown Enterprises in late 1995. This came out just a couple years after Magic. And it seems like it was driven by that initial success of Magic, but this is before the movies, like way before the movies. So this was like early, this is like building on that like 70s and 80s nostalgia, Gen X people who read you know, Lord of the Rings in high school, hid in the back corner of the library. And it was generally successful. It won two Origins Awards. It was around for 5 years.
Yeah,
people really liked it. The reason it died is because ICE lost the license. Which happens a lot with Lord of the Rings stuff. That license bounces around a lot.
So I can imagine it doing, again, this is a timing issue more than anything else too.
Yeah, 100%. This is a game that I think people generally liked when it was around, but it just, yeah, it, the license was short-lived. The game didn't live long enough to like build. If you look at the cards, they look like Magic cards. Like those early Magic cards, it's very, very close. So, and you would not be wrong to think that this was made by Wizards, but it wasn't. So it's just like, this is what CCGs look like, right? It's like, nah, you're just ripping off their artwork.
Hey, so what happened to Lord of the Rings? Did they ever get another CCG by chance?
They did. Yeah. Oh my,
get out of here.
Yeah. So, 2 years later, Decipher picked up the license, and they released Lord of the Rings trading card game. Right? And this came out a month before Fellowship hit the theaters.
Sure.
So the first couple sets were just based explicitly on the movies. So this one ran for 7 years, was also quite successful. It also won Origins Awards for Best Trading Card Game.
Sure.
And people were generally very happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's just that same story over and over again of where the game ended because they lost the license.
Yes.
Now there's some discussion about why they lost the license. Part of that could be that Decipher itself was kind of going under at that point and they just couldn't afford to renew it. They chose not to renew it. It's not really clear why, but that's, again, that's what happened. The license expired. They could not keep producing cards. There's a lot of content though. So over the course of the game, they released 19 sets. And if you're not familiar with TCG set releases, they're usually like 3 to 4 a year. So 19 sounds like a lot, but that's 6 or 7 years worth of content. But again, another really solid game with a lot of engaged, organized play around it. And people were, like a lot of these things, surprised when it died.
Yeah. And again, it's coming back. It's another thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of coming back in the sense that it's now with the third company and that Wizards of the Coast got the license to use with Magic.
Sure.
Which is ironic because that first set was from Ice was pretty just like a Magic clone. So yeah. Now we have an actual Magic set of Lord of the Rings with Tales from the Beyond.
And again, it's crazy because obviously it's making all the money. Everyone loves it. It's playing great. So the difference of a company in a couple of years, it's just radical. Just yeah. Radical. Yeah. And again, no. 2.6 million for Post Malone, you know?
Yeah, so much money for that one ring card. Oh, man. So that's one IP. The next IP that's kind of bounced around a lot, and this one's bouncing around a whole lot and is about to have a fourth, is Star Wars. There have been 3 collectible card games for Star Wars. There's a fourth one coming out next year from Fantasy Flight, which we did not have a chance to demo at Gen Con, but we saw it there. And each of these games was successful for a short period of time. Two of them I've played quite extensively. The first is the Star Wars customizable card game from Decipher. This came out in 95. I was obsessed with this game when I was in middle school, into high school. Played constantly, had a ton of content for it. And it made its way through the original trilogy, Shadows of the Empire, and Phantom Menace in terms of content. And that's sure. When it died in 2001.
Yep.
These cards were, like, I would hunt them down. We would find places that were selling them. They were always sold out. It was incredible. We had a local card store at one point, and they were selling off the cards, like wow. All their singles. So we went up there and bought a bunch of really rare cards for $3 a piece.
Crazy.
I got an Obi-Wan and a Boba Fett and a Luke Skywalker for $3 a piece. I later sold my cards when I was in college for pizza money, which... Because the game was dead and they weren't worth anything. Yeah. And now they're worth more because all of the millennials that are now in their 30s, coming on 40s, are like, I want those cards back. So,
that's right. It's the Bitcoin of TCGs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this game was fine. Like, I've gone back and played it a little bit online. It's actually not that good of a game, but I mean, it's a fine game. There's nothing wrong with it. But compared to later releases, it was functional. But it was the first one, and it just used movie artwork. It didn't, there wasn't drawings or anything. It was just stills, but that made it all the better. Love that.
Yeah, you and I played the TCG, right? The two player.
We played the third one on this list that okay. We're going to get to.
Woof. All right. I'll let you get to that.
Yeah. That's, so the second one,
they all blur together.
There's a lot. So the second one was Wizards of the Coast, once again trying to expand their Magicverse. They launched Star Wars the Trading Card Game in 2002 when they got the license after Decipher lost the license. And it lasted for 3 years. So again, not quite as long as Decipher. They probably released about as much content as Decipher because they released it much faster. They did get the rest of the prequels in there because they were running these during the prequel era. So we got, and they just named their sets after the movies for the most part. Mm-hmm. Game of the three, I think it's probably the least well regarded. Like it was fine. But it didn't have a lot of development behind it. I think the development team behind it, like it was designed by Richard Garfield too, which is crazy because he designed a bunch of these games, but it just didn't really set itself apart the way that the other two games did. The last one, at least until the next one, which is Star Wars Unlimited, is Star Wars Destiny, which is a collectible Dyson card game that was released in 2016, and it lasted for 4 years. This game died in 2020. It's hard to know if it died because of COVID or if they just used that as an excuse, but it died during COVID. effectively. The last set came out in early 2020, and they basically killed it for dead at the end of 2020. This is the last time I went in on anything collectible from Fantasy Flight, because they just kept killing stuff, and I was just like, I can't do it. Although, as we've learned, a lot of companies kill stuff. This game was really good. It had, I think, 5 total sets, so not nearly as many as some other games, especially the number of years it was around. But you had a combination of dice, you roll the dice, and the cards will tell you what the dice can do. And it was just a very dynamic, tactical game. Very clever. It seemed like something they could take and put onto other IPs, but by that point, Fantasy Flight was not doing anything else in other than like Arkham and Marvel Champions. So we have 3 pretty good games, a Richard Garfield game in there, the OG Decipher game, Destiny, and they're all super dead for Star Wars.
Oof. I have some of the TCG, and I do have some of these CCG originals somewhere. Ooh. Somewhere.
Man, I would kill to get some of those original CCG cards again. I sold all my cards to a friend, and there's no way he's giving them back to me now. But
yeah, time.
I know. I would never play that game again either. I just want them for nostalgia. That's it.
No, of course.
Another game kind of in the same era, Star Trek customizable card game. Decipher started, came out in 94. It's actually older than Star Wars and lasted longer than Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
I had a few of these. Did you ever buy any of these? I know you're a big Star Trek guy.
I'm a big Star Trek fan. I don't remember buying these. I don't know why it would escape me, but I don't remember it, honestly. I don't. Just skipped.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing. Like this. So the second edition released in 2002, and then they had 14 releases. The first edition was 1994, and they had, I think, almost 25 releases. So there's a lot of content for this game. I don't think it's as fondly remembered as the Decipher Star Wars game, but I remember buying some cards because I wanted a Jean-Luc Picard something. And you could get it in the starter deck, so I did. But yeah, it was definitely popular for a long time. All right, just a couple more here. Two more that everybody will remember. First, we have Netrunner, which was another Wizards of the Coast attempt in 1996. Also designed by Richard Garfield. Also died pretty quickly in 2001. This one came back with Android Netrunner in a different format. It wasn't a CCG, but it used a lot of the same ideas, right? You have the runner versus the corporation. And the LCG that Fantasy Flight released for several years is one of the best games of all time. Brilliant game. It takes the core ideas of Richard Garfield's design and makes it into a LCG instead of like collectible card game, which is obviously expensive. And that also eventually died because Wizards wanted the license back, and then they decided not to do anything with it, which is frustrating. So I think it's listed in it's listed as saying they filed the trademark application in June 2021, and in February 2022, they said, never mind.
Oof.
And abandoned the application.
Oof. Yeah.
Wizards of the Coast, man. That's a company. That's a company that does stuff.
Yeah.
So hopefully we get some more Netrunner content eventually, but Wizards is just kind of sitting on the IP at the moment.
Yeah.
Which is lame, because it was good both times.
True.
Last one on the list, we have World of Warcraft trading card game. This is from Upper Deck, and it released in 2006, a couple years after the game came out. And it ran for 7 years, so it made it up till 2013, which is pretty solid. One of the reasons this probably died is because Hearthstone came out the following year. The license was not renewed with Upper Deck, and then less than a year later, Hearthstone was released. So this is probably just Blizzard being like, we're going to do it ourselves. We'll get all the money. We don't have to produce anything physically.
Yes.
So go away. but the game was very successful. There's a lot of, you know, open play around it, and, you know, it's the perfect world for it. Just because there's so much content and so much lore, and the cards were kind of ugly, but, you know, all the cards were kind of ugly back then.
Yeah, again, I think this is another one which was like, I remember seeing it, but again, not playing it so much. And again, back in the day, like you mentioned too, like, everything's going online, everything's going to be digital. And you're just like, sure, because it's the future? And then people are like, no, I actually like to have physical things, you know, just...
Yeah, you can play Loricana online, but people are still paying $300 for cards.
That's what.
Why not?
100%. So... Yep, and there's conversations about having cards with almost, like, weird kind of NFTs connected to it. There's some kind of early discussions about, so you could kind of sell your cards online and people could print out their own versions of the card. So you get to keep the card, but you don't own the card anymore for competition play. And I'm just like, creating a better secondary market is not what I need. That's not a thing. I just want to play the game.
Super gross. I hate that. Don't do that. Please don't do that if you're publishing these. That's gross.
No, absolutely. So it's a graveyard, man. It's a graveyard.
It is a graveyard. It takes a lot of money to make these games. It takes even more money to run them. And if you don't make 500,000,000% back, whatever it is you're looking for, then they fail pretty quickly. But been a lot of them, and a lot of people have a lot of these cards. And a lot of nostalgia.
Yeah, and I think for a lot, like, I remember going on eBay at some point way back in the day, and like, oh, there's a Babylon 5 CCG, and I'm like, that's fantastic. In my whole life, I've never seen this game anywhere except on eBay. So, like, they produced it. I don't know who played it. Like, again, it might have just been collectors, because there was not organized play out there in the world. And it's still going for crazy money because, again, collectors, as far as that's concerned. But the thing that's always pushed back, and it may have been the same thing with Star Trek, is when you look at the CCG cards, the amount of text and, you know, like, this, but this, but this, and this, and just, like, there's your picture, and then, like, a legal document of different things that it does. And I'm just like, no. Just like, every card can't have like several paragraphs, you know? I can't play games like that. I'm sorry. Just can't do it. I don't, like, card games should not have fine print. And all these card games, again, the lesser of the card games have these, like, extensive fine print and, like, dictionary level action words on them. And I just can't do it. So I would love to do it, but I can't. So, I don't know. That's the thing. So, hopefully all of you out there, if you did collect these, you got a chance to play them. Or maybe you just collect them because they're fun to collect because they're great IPs. But, again, companies. Let's just leave it out there. But, again, also, Lord of the Rings came back, so maybe other things? I don't know.
I mean, you never know. Star Wars will come back next year. It'll fail in 3 years.
Oh, jeez. And then, of course, Loricana, friends. Loricana. So, I don't know. Enjoy your Schadenfreude, I guess. Like, watch the other things burn, because eventually there can... I think the other thing we should mention, too, Anthony, is, like, if you're not into these CCGs, right? The living card games are a little different, but if you're not into CCGs, like, you must have a place to play these.
Yeah.
And there are only so many friendly local game stores that are still out there in the world, so it's harder to get to play these games out there. And Magic and Pokemon and somewhat Yu-Gi-Oh, they dominate those Friday nights and those Saturdays and everything else. So, like, where does even another card game, even if it's Loricana, find space in a game store to be played when everything else is being played all the time?
Yeah,
I mean, Flesh and Blood is a new game that's out there. We have some friends that play a lot of it, and it's finding some hard, it's having some hard times finding spots to be played. And if you don't see it in a game store and you don't see it being played by people, forget conventions. Conventions are an anomaly, right? Like, people go to conventions to play, you know, collectible card games. Like, that's a whole other thing. You got to have a local game store. There's very few. Or a game cafe. Very few. And there has to be time for the new card games to find oxygen. And I don't think there is. I don't know where you play a new one. I don't care how good it is. I think Loricana is going to be the interesting kind of bellwether of this. Like, is it going to be able to be played? Collected, yes, but will be played?
That's the big question. If it can't be played, it's going to die.
inevitably, because again, there's only so much collectors can do to keep something up. And the company's going to have to invest in the meta to kind of like update and change things as time goes on. And collectors don't care about that. They don't care. So organized play, people. It's been the bane of every publisher's existence. I know that. We know that because we've tried it. like the X-Wing Miniatures game. A lot of those organized play, Fantasy Flight and stuff. Yeah. It's a lot of stuff out there, people. So enjoy your CCGs, enjoy your TCGs, enjoy your LCGs. But just be careful out there. That's all we're saying. Be careful, because it happens. But yeah, good times. Until next time, Anthony, as always, this is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And we'll save you all a seat at Friday Night Magic, because that's what happens out there in the world.
That's the only one.
That's the only one, people. Just get on board. We have no choice.
The rest will die.
Take care, everyone.
Bye.
See ya.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.